You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahi ahi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, kou mei a toka ingoa.
Ko sofia toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. How are you today, Maya?
I'm great. We've just had a mimosa in studio.
It's so good.
I feel
like pressure taking on a show right after that.
I know. I was in like celebration mode, keg and mimosa, and then I'm like, well, shit.
Now we gotta lock in. Hold up. We got a stacked show today. If I can, coming up on the show, Maya, what have you got?
I had a kōrero with artist Raisa McLean about her current show Heatwave on at Room. Soph, what have you got today?
I had a kōrero with senior curator of international art at Auckland Art Gallery, Toyo Tamaki, Dr. Sophie Matheson, about the gallery's latest exhibition, A Century of Modern Art, surveying the visionary painters who transformed Western modern art. I also had a kōrero with artist Esther Stone about her show opening at Melanie Roger Gallery next week for Matariki, Taonga Tuku Iho.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on these pieces, so tuku pata he mai, you can text us on 5395 Matoru Iwarima, Waimairane, or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also after the show, Kaua e Ware Ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki enei kōrero anō hei pakihiri rokiroki maronga i te pai tukutuku o Irirangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various Artists.
A Century of Modern Art is Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tamaki's latest exhibition, surveying a century of visionary and influential painters who transformed modern art. Exhibiting the likes of Claude Monet, Edgar Degas and Vincent van Gogh, and premier examples by pioneering artists of the American and European avant-garde, A Century of Modern Art is an extensive collection of 57 works by 53 artists. The exhibition takes the viewer through the evolution of modern art through key defined art movements, beginning with the Impressionists of the 1860s, making its way through movements such as Post-Impressionism, Symbolism, Cubism, Surrealism, and Abstract Expressionism. These works revolutionize the Western modern art and continue to inspire those in the present. I had a kōrero with co-curator and senior curator of international art, Dr. Sophie Matheson, about the show and working with the Toledo Museum of Art to bring this collection to Tamaki Makaurau. A Century of Modern Art is exhibiting works on loan from the Toledo Museum of Art, Ohio, and you co-curated the exhibition with curator of American art at Toledo, Erin Corrales-Diaz. Can you tell me a bit about that relationship first and how the exhibition came to be and took shape?
Well, it started off, as many travelling exhibitions do, as a checklist that we received. And very often you just judge a show by the quality of what's in it. There were no details particularly about the themes, about the significance of each work, but it was absolutely obvious that we had an eye-popping array of works right across the show, from its beginnings in the 1860s right through to the 1960s. It's a century span. And so when you have that sort of amount of quality compressed into an exhibition of 57 works, you just really look forward to how it's going to sort of shape up. And it was quite a long way down the track before we actually knew what the themes were that the curator in Toledo had in mind. And even then, it was quite schematic. So I just worked with those themes to help write the labels and to flesh out some of the thematic texts on the walls. And then I took it from there, really, in terms of writing room brochures for our general public. I'm responsible, really, for translating a theme that's arrived to us into terms that are really relatable for New Zealand audiences. So it's my knowledge of local audiences that helps to craft the show and those final texts that appear on the walls, in the audio guide, in the brochures, in the advertising, etc. So it's really two minds working together on the same checklist. And luckily, I think we've followed a fairly straight down the line sort of story about the development of avant-garde in the 20th century. And so we were never in any dispute about the basic parameters, the basic facts of this historical story. If you were to pick up a book that just encompassed a century of modern art, you could really just rely on Toledo's knockout pictures to sort of to cover it, because they their institution was founded in 1901, and they didn't inherit a ready-made collection from anyone, like a private collection. They inherited instead a significant seed corn funding to go out and buy the best of the best. And so they're really starting their collecting roughly at the same time that the avant-garde was kind of invented, and roughly at the same time that that those paintings from France were arriving on the American market. So they were buying adventurously from early on, and with this idea that they had the money to sit back and wait for the best of the best to come along, they really didn't try to be comprehensive, to sort of infill all the little gaps with lesser works. They've just cherry-picked what was the best of what was available. And what we've ended up with, following 130 years of their collecting, is really a very, very handsome array of knockout works. And they also had directors and curators who had the boldness to buy very modern art, even when it was not popular among the museum establishment. So they've really done some very visionary collecting, and it's a reminder of how hard it is for other institutions now to play catch-up. So we are looking at some extraordinary Mondrians and Monets, etc., that were bought in relatively early days, and it's a really great credit to Toledo Museum of Art that they basically bought according to their convictions and their eye, and not according to local taste, because they were buying ahead of their time.
And these shifts in artistic expression represent a shift towards more personal reflection in the artist's practices. Would you be able to speak to how the social and cultural changes are reflected in the evolution of art practice as artists shift direction and made bolder changes to their style, as can be seen in this exhibition?
Absolutely. And you see it right through the show from beginning to end, but the show does open in the second part of the 19th century, and that's really the tail end of Romanticism, where personal, private, subjective feeling was very important to creativity. You know, if you think of Chopin and the Romantic musicians, well, and poets and writers. So the artists, the Impressionists, really did paint according to their own sense of truth and authenticity. So we already see in the very first room little landscapes along the beach, say by Caillebotte, of insignificant little buildings on the coastline, and yet these are immensely important to Caillebotte, who love the sea and love the regattas and all of the water sports in summer in that area on the Normandy coast. Things have personal significance. They're also painted in a very modern style, and the two things come together beautifully again and again. And we see it particularly in the second room, where there are Impressionist portraits, and they're almost always of lovers, of childhood friends, of nieces, nephews, etc. These are people who are very close to the artists themselves, and what is irrelevant is social status, money, wealth, all of the general signifiers. Portraits do not have to be of people who are perfect looking or a significance in society. And so, again, you're plunged right into the private world of the artist. Then in the next room, which is, we call it re-envisioning the world, that's about the artist's private idea of an ideal world. And so we see Monet's beautiful personal vision of the water lily gardens that he planted and created at Giverny, that he never really leaves, that he's created his own paradise. We see the world of rural France that Van Gogh liked to think of through the idea that he was getting back to a primitive and more pure kind of humanity. We see Tahiti, which his friend Gauguin saw through very, very rose-tinted eyes as well, glasses as well. So we see these sort of paradises that artists were striving towards, and they are not very closely connected to reality. In fact, they're an escape from modernity. And so that's very personal, and we can see it in the colours too. They've escaped from naturalism, and we're getting these beautiful bronze purples and pinks and oranges and aquas, using all of the modern paint colours, the aniline dye colours. So suddenly things become a little bit technicolour and very, very personal. And realism has vanished in the process. And the next two rooms are really about how the avant-garde and how cubism and impressionism sort of freed everybody else up to approach familiar subjects in new ways. So we have two gorgeous rooms of one of based on the human figure and how it gets broken down into twisted and fragmented little bits and pieces as artists tried to make personal comments about humanity in the world in the light of terrible events like the First World War or earth-shattering theories like psychoanalysis. So modernity has really come up and grabbed people by the throats by 1910 or so. Mm. We see it in this room, broken down images of the human figure. It's tremendously exciting and bold. The classical figure, the boring, staid classical figure of human perfection has gone. The accompanying room is about landscape and still life. And again, artists have completely re-envisaged both of these familiar subjects with modern eyes. So we see it in the palettes, we see it in abstraction, we see it in these fantastic bold colours and strong lines. And these are very personal visions. And it reminds us of how Pizarro told young artists, don't go looking for new subject matter. Look at the familiar subject matter through new eyes, and we see that in this room. And it's star-studded, this little still life room. It's got Morandi in there, Pizarro, Paul Klee, Yves Tanguy. It's hard to know where to look. Braque, a superb wartime Braque. And then if I can just quickly skip through towards the end.
Yeah, perfect.
We see how many of those avant-garde artists have to really scarper to America with the Second World War. So the Second World War comes up with a shock. It wants to turn back the clock. Fascism wants to turn back the clock of the avant-garde. It's become very unsafe for Bauhaus artists and experimental artists to continue working in Germany. Increasingly, it becomes unsafe for them to continue working in Paris. And so we see this scramble as all sorts of artists and art institutions in America attempt to effectively airlift or spirit away some of the great talents from old Europe and into the new world. So we see people like Josef Albers from the Bauhaus or Mahori Naj from the Bauhaus or Mondrian from Paris, not much English between them. And they're suddenly pitched into New York and North Carolina and these little places, teaching academies. And they start to teach what they know to new generations of American artists. So from that point onwards in the show, we still see how America takes on firsthand from these emigre artists the principles of things like abstraction and starts to interpret their own world in America through these principles of abstraction so that abstraction stops being a sort of a foreign phenomenon associated with outsiders, communists, etc. It loses a lot of those associations, and it becomes a sort of an American as apple pie sort of phenomenon. And so we see the shift across to abstraction through artists like Anne Reinhart, Helen Frankenthaler, who invents sort of colour field painting. And the final room is really about the story of how those American artists had shed the painting of objects and had moved to pure abstraction and then start to come back from the brink of abstraction and start to play around with the figurative again. And so we end up with a sort of a reconciling. The figurative comes back into abstract painting, and so we end up with a last room, which is almost a sweeping survey of the very great abstract painters, the very great colour field painters like Morris Lewis, and the birth of pop in Robert Rauschenberg. So it's an absolutely sweeping story. It's very hard to tour, to guide through a story like that in, say, an hour, I struggle because we're looking at so many major moments and so many major players.
Totally. I can imagine that would be very difficult to take on. But as we're talking about this, you know, I think what's so striking about this exhibition is it is such a great educational exhibition on art history. And there is, you know, you could talk about it for hours. There's so many stories that come out within these works and within this evolution that this covers. What do you think is the importance of an exhibition of this type being held in Tāmaki Makaurau?
I think it's fantastic for us here in Auckland because we've got the Robertson Gift in an adjacent gallery, which is this wonderful act of philanthropy that brought 15 great modern masters to our gallery and has transformed our gallery's collection, has transformed the gallery's status in the world. But now we have a chance to sort of we've been living with some of those stories about the rise of the avant-garde in the last year or two with that show that's up. And it's free. And now we have a chance to sort of delve into other examples and other facets of the similar story. And so we're sort of getting this wonderful new chapter where you can go from the Robertson Paths to Modernity show across to the Toledo show. And we're also looking at really the best of the best. And it's a tremendous thing to see superb examples. It helps us to keep our eye attuned to you know, what we might like to collect in the future, what we might aspire to, or why we can't, you know. But for me, it has really forced me to... I'm trying to think in terms of being very, very strategic about how we add to our own collection. We may not be able to afford a superb Max Beckmann German expressionist, but we might find something small, or also a wonderful example. And so it helps us to be strategic. It also helps us to stay connected to the world of international art museums, because it's actually getting more and more expensive to travel. We're doing it less often. And we have a new generation of young people who do not assume that they'll head straight to Europe or overseas the second they finish a degree or the second they finish school. COVID and cost of living has changed our expectations, sadly. And so the role of a museum like ours is to bring the world to Auckland in the meantime. I think it's very, very important. Also, I think it's great that we have this conversation with great institutions across the world, because not only do we learn a lot about them, they learn a lot about us in the process. And people from Toledo are realising that we've got these superb collections of New Zealand art to be tapped. Mm. It's a conversation that will just keep going. I'm hugely into this idea of internationalism and exchange, cultural exchange. I don't believe in putting up cultural walls, and I say the more exchange, the better. We live off that sort of, it creates possibilities for all of us.
I feel like that really nicely leads on to my last question, because this exhibition marks the beginning of a series of exhibitions at Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tāmaki in the coming years. How is this exhibition influencing the direction of the gallery and its focus, particularly for larger international shows?
Look, I think this is a taster of things to come. I think we should be getting used to having wonderful offerings, particularly in the winter season, to look forward to. And I think that we are building up erudition, familiarity with great artists and great examples by them. And I think that the important thing is it helps to shape our expectations. We shouldn't regard this as a one-off. We should assume that there'll be a constant stream of shows of this calibre, and we will be aiming to bring, you know, quality and variety to Auckland every year. It's amazing how difficult it can be, and how much effort can go into staging one particular show. There's so many things that can get in the way of a good programme, a good forward programme, but I think that Aucklanders deserve it, New Zealanders deserve it. I can't think of too many institutions across New Zealand that are doing what we're doing, and I think that we should be flying the flag for these great cultural offerings.
That was Senior Curator of International Art at Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tāmaki, Dr. Sophie Matheson, speaking to me about the gallery's latest exhibition, A Century of Modern Art. The exhibition is on now until the 28th of September 2025.
What's it all for?
Various artists,
We'll be right back after a short break. You're on BFM. This is Various Artists.
The Auckland Philharmonia is doing another performance of that famous guy's music.
Who?
You know that guy? Ba 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 ba.
Oh, he looks kind of grumpy in that painting.
Beethoven!
The Auckland Philharmonia plays Beethoven's iconic Fifth Symphony at the Auckland Town Hall, Wednesday, June 25th at 6:30. For tickets and more info, go to aucklandphil.nz.
Check out the coolest exhibition at New Zealand Maritime Museum, Hui Te Ananui a Tangaroa, Into Ocean and Ice. Go on a polar journey to Antarctica and experience five artists' interpretations of the fragile beauty of this epic landscape. From Ernest Shackleton's heroic expeditions to the climate-threatened island of South Georgia. Into Ocean and Ice. On now until August 31st, 2025. Free entry with museum admission. For more info, go to maritimemuseum.co.nz.
Challenge your senses in complete darkness with Darkfield, Seance and Flight. In Aotea Square now. Step inside two custom-built shipping containers and be transported as a strange new world unfolds around you with 360-degree audio and sensory effects that will leave you questioning reality. Darkfield, Seance and Flight. On until June 15 in Aotea Square. For tickets and more info, head to aucklandlive.co.nz.
Oh, conditions are perfect!
And there's a monster set heading our way.
The Grogans are about to hit our shores.
So don't soil your wetsuit. Just tune in to 95BFM Drive for a chance to win tickets to the show.
Keep that V-card handy though, because you need that to win the tickets. The Grogans, Stagger Album Release Tour.
Double whammy, Saturday, September 6th. Tickets available now from Moshtix.
Do you growl towards the weekend on a Friday afternoon like the cockroach that hides in the corner of your room and crawls towards your sleeping face at night to slither inside your ear and lay its eggs?
Well, it's lucky we have this show to jolt you awake and stop all that disgusting crawling.
It's the Friday 2 to 4 with a brain-birthing cast of DJs ready to get you hyped for the weekend.
Oh, that's a good art.
Raisa McLean is a Melbourne-based interdisciplinary artist navigating her practice through a mode of visual songmaking. McLean produces bodies of work that speak to themes of hauntology and the ephemerality of memory. In an attempt to hold and to give form to memory, McLean explores multiple modes of narrative within her current show On at Heatwave to welcome viewers into an installation of a fragmented diary. Memories of summers, both past and present and future, each haunted by the other. I had a chat with Raisa about her practice and current show Heatwave on Now at Room. Here it is now.
To start off by talking to me a little bit about your practice as a whole, the kind of key thematic undercurrents that run throughout your practice.
Yeah, I think that my practice probably mainly centers around interrogating memory and like making it into something physical and sort of questioning the reliability of objects. Yeah, as a way of conveying memory. I always like to think of my practice as a form of visual song making, and that's kind of where I really start with making my works. I kind of almost wish that I was, making music instead of visual art. I think the way that like a piece of music, either through songwriting, melody or sampling, can allow narrative transportation to a listener, that's sort of what I want to achieve with my artworks. Similar to how like in a song there's sometimes like a you, a me, I or we. And like within that, when listening to that, we can place our own lives and narratives into the personal narrative or sonic tapestry of the performer. I'm really interested in, that way of accessing and sharing memories to an audience. There's sort of no way of kind of knowing or being able to scrutinize the narrative. And it just sort of boils down to like emotion. I'm also really interested at the moment in hauntology as a way of approaching artworks. So that kind of idea that everything is haunted by a lost future and there's no real present. My practice definitely operates like that. It's very much not mindful or present, but concerned with memory, with the present also in a way being looked at as memory when making work. Yeah, I'm interested in how when making an object, it kind of, the narrative or memory that's attached to it disappears through the making, in the sense that, like, by the object existing, that kind of indicates that the moment has already passed and doesn't exist anymore. So there's an implied absence. And I've always been really into that. Like, as a kid, I would hold on to little bits of rubbish and stuff. I just felt really emotionally attached to the memory they held, and it felt like throwing something away was throwing away a bit of my memory, as the logic was like, what if I needed it at some point in the future if I wanted to recall something? Yeah, and kind of this feeling of like a label off a plastic bottle that can say much more than what can be thought of in the mind about a specific point in time, because our brains are fallible, but it feels like objects aren't. So I guess, essentially my practice kind of questions the reliability of objects as a way of conveying memory.
Your current show, Heatwave On At Room, circulates this idea of summer, the somewhat fleeting season that basks within its own memory. Can you speak about how this particular body of work arose? What drew you to this concept of summer as this embodiment of a kind of vessel of temporariness?
Yeah, so I think initially when I was working towards the show, I was thinking about artworks as traces and looking at this idea from Derrida that nothing exists out of the text, in this case, the text being visual art, that in the creation of a piece of artwork that's particularly one that's like concerned with memory, there's like an implied absence of the real thing. Like, even if you were to paint like a photorealistic portrait of someone, it still shows a moment in time that can't be recreated exactly. Like the sitting, the facial expression in that moment is gone. It's like even the most kind of objective, matter of fact artwork still has sentiment, like it's still sentimental. And I was kind of just struggling to find like a way to house that concept within my art. So yeah, this, like, the centering of summer wasn't something that I was initially really focused on, but the works themselves were being made in the lead up to, during and after summer. And I think then I kind of began to naturally associate them with that, just sort of like all the conversations that I was having. It's like a funny season in that like it's spoken about throughout the year, and then when it comes, like, you're talking about summers from past years and things that happened in years before, and like just there's this real expectation for it to be so much better than any other point in the year. And it holds a lot of potential in that way, particularly like here in Melbourne, where it's like the difference between summer, winter and summer is like so big, like it's freezing and then it's really, really hot. It sort of feels like every year we anticipate something better than the last year. I was also thinking like about, I don't know if you've seen on social media, if it's a thing in Auckland at the moment, but like this sort of resurgence or obsession with that like 2010s like Spring Breakers kind of like Calvin Harris EDM like Ibiza kind of summer, Last Night Was a Movie, that kind of thing. Like I was thinking about that and like how that sort of become a meme now or something, or like reflected on as a great time. And like even in that there's something sad about that, like, yeah, the way that summers from the past are sort of monumentalized into just, it's funny in that sense that like it's a season that can never quite be present. I think it connects to that concept of hauntology as well, in the sense of like as a season it's always haunted by like what it could have been, even if it's really great in that moment. And even just in sort of like film and music, presented as something that's really ephemeral, in the sense of like maybe like a summer romance. Or I was even looking to Hiroshima Mon Amour, which I think is set in the summer, and how that whole thing is sort of like, it's a film about forgetting. And I think that there's such a fear of forgetting what happens in the summer.
And with this attempt to hold and to give form to memory, you have created these physical records of a kind of fleeting memory. Could you walk me through a little bit about your material process and the making of these forms of memory and their use of subject matter and text, along with your uses of different substrates and techniques?
Yeah, so all my artworks are created very like painstakingly by hand. So all the pieces and tape are cut with a scalpel, and all the embroidery in the show is hand stitched. And it's important to me that I do it in that way. Like, I'm aware that there are other processes that would make it easier, but I'm interested in that sort of those methods. Like, they take so long and they're so obsessive. Like, I think about the author Deborah Levy and how she has these living autobiographies. And that's kind of like, because the works are being made, so many different things happen, and the way in which I'm approaching them is different each time I come to like return to a current work that I'm making. Other thing that's important to me in the materiality of my works is that none of them are really finished in a practical sense. Like, the works with tape, they're like functionally stencils. There's just pieces of steel that are prepared for sandblasting, but they're never going to get to that form. So in that way, they're kind of, yeah, they've got this potential to have a future of like a sandblasted piece of metal with that kind of etching, but then, yeah, they're not. And yeah, the way I've done that connects with that idea of them being sort of objects that are trying to keep hold of memory, but yeah, they're never really kind of done.
And is there a relationship between the like the subject matter and the images that you use and the pairing with the particular substrate, or is it all just kind of like a organic thing that happens in the process, or do you put a lot of thought into the pairing of these?
I'd say it's kind of both. Like, it's definitely can be organic, but there are like quite like a lot of my pieces do have sort of materials that relate to the subject matter in the work. I think one piece in the show, it shows like a house with some pool balls around it, and the backing is this corrugated iron, and that relates to like my back porch where I've got a pool table. Yeah, I think that the ways in which the material connects to the subject matter might be something that like only me or my friends could pick up on. That's kind of also important in my works, that there's sort of like, I guess, like Easter eggs of things that can be picked up on by different people, whether those be like references to like things in like pop culture or like materials that maybe my friends would recognize.
There's this real sense of a narrative within your body of work, although a disoriented narrative, that is. It feels as though you're stepping into a fragmented diary, stumbling upon these little nuggets of memory, trying to gain a sense of orientation within the work. I'm really interested in these alternative nuggets of storytelling that we are offered as the audience, both in the show text written by you and also within a response text written by your friend Juliet Berkeley. And a little nugget that I love the most is a link to a playlist that I suspect you've created. Could you speak to the inclusion of these?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I go about like creating narratives for work is always like layering truth with fiction. And that's the same thing that I spoke to Juliet about when we were discussing creating a response text. It was important that that kind of like reflected the show and the kind of vignettes, like narrative vignettes that were kind of present in the show. Everything sort of like not quite fully formed. Yeah, like you said, they're kind of like nuggets, and it's hard to like establish a clear narrative. I think in a way, like fiction does a better job at relaying a moment than the sort of a didactic retelling of it. I've always really loved autofictional writers like Annie Ernaux, but she sort of like weaves her own personal narratives in with like sort of like semi kind of fictionalized things. And yeah, that has really, I suppose, inspired how I approach narrative in my work. Because yeah, I was thinking of like, how can you kind of earnestly retell a moment with just the truth? Like, you can tell something, yeah, in a didactic, objective way, but it kind of loses the power or emotion in it. Like, how lives are so mundane, something can feel like a simple moment can feel really emotional and powerful, but just telling it as it was can fall flat. And again, like, I think back to like how that's done in music or songwriting, like the mundanity is elevated through a melody, but in visual art and writing, maybe that can be elevated through like fiction or metaphor. So yeah, all the different like bits and pieces in the show, like the narratives, like there are images of things that literally happened. Like, there's an image of my friends at the pub next to a beer glass, but then there's also images in there that are either like partially real with bits that I've just added in, or like different moments that have been collaged together into one moment. The piece with the poker chips is that that's different images from different times with my friends all sort of smushed together into one. Yeah. And the playlist, yeah, I mean, like I said before, music is a really big, like a, I don't know what I'd call it. I guess it motivates the works. I think that the way in which memories can be accessed through music is really interesting and moving, and something that I hope can also be achieved through visual art. The songs in the playlists are sort of like connect, like a lot of them are connected to like different summers that I've had. Like they're associated with different personal memories. Some of them are associated with making the works themselves. And yeah, it's sort of, I guess I keep adding to the playlist as well, so it's not really finished either, like the works.
Yeah, I think it's a really beautiful touch, and your song and music has such a powerful link to memory. Within your show write-up, you mention that giving form to memory also begins its erosion. And for me, this erosion is perhaps it's opening in a way. The erosion of your memory acts as a kind of passage for viewers' memories to enter into, an expansion of personal memory into a joining of collective memory or a passover into the viewer's own memory. Is this something that you anticipated with the show? And what are your hopes for viewers as they navigate the show?
Yeah, that is pretty much how I hoped the show would be experienced. So it's nice to hear that. I've always aimed for my works to be experienced similar to, sorry, I feel like I keep going on about songs, but like I've always wanted my works to be experienced in a similar way to that. Like the memories that I've drawn from are my own, but they disappear when they're perceived as an object, which like ideally allows for the viewer to transport their own narrative into the work in the same way as you would when you're listening to a song. I think in that sense, the memories kind of don't matter. I mean, they do. Like, yeah, it's fun when people are speculating on who or what a work might be about, but they're made their own to the viewer through a combination of the memory of like viewing the work itself, but also maybe what personal memory is attached to that viewing. Like, I don't know, that also depends on like how someone's coming to the work in the same way that someone might be coming to a song. Like the way something's perceived is different if you've maybe like made a new friend or like met someone new, or if you've just like experienced the breakdown of a friendship or relationship, it changes the perception of the work and the different ways in which it might specifically be found as moving.
That was Raissa McLean talking to me about her current show Heatwave on Now at Room until the 5th of July.
Because we were feeling a little extra, a little cunty.
Gorgeous. Now we've got some Julia Jacqueline for you, one of my absolute favourites. So here's Pool Party. Enjoy.
Said I won't blame you now, but I got your call. Darling, but is it art?
Taonga Tuku Iho is Esther Stone's first exhibition with Melanie Roger Gallery opening next Wednesday as part of Matariki celebrations across Karangahape Road. Stone's practice centres on the stories and knowledge of her iwi, Ngāti Porou, hapu and whānau, by which whenua and whakapapa are weaved within the language and processes of traditional Māori weaving and tāniko, which she specialises in. Each work is a product of intensive research, gathering and weaving, whereby the artist explores potential futures for traditional Māori methods of making. I had a kōrero with Esther about the show and her practice.
Your practice is largely guided by stories and knowledge of your hapu and whānau and intertwined with whenua and whakapapa. Can you speak to how these influences come through and inform your practice?
I mean, I grew up like on my whenua, which I'm really fortunate that I've been able to do with my, you know, whānau and my hapu around. And I don't know, it's just always been there, and I feel like I can't make anything without it coming through. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, totally. So it's quite omnipresent for you.
Yeah.
With each piece in this exhibition, Taonga Tuku Iho, it's installed with Matai Tang and groove floorboards from your nan's house and totara milled by your father from your farm over 20 years ago. And I think it's a really special touch that really ties in those ideas and says a lot about the thought behind your practice. Can you speak to the inclusion of those elements specifically and how including them alongside and within your work influences your practice as a whole?
Well, when I was trying to figure out how to install these pieces without it, looking too, I don't know, too polished and too Stepford Wives house kind of time. and I have been working in the museum and gallery sector, like with Māori Taonga, and I'm really into like carving and stuff like that. So finding these, I don't know, it just felt right when I found these. I'm quite an intuitive maker, like I'll let the materials sort of tell me where the project is supposed to go. So yeah, I found them and I thought that'll be pretty cool and it won't make it look so polished but still looks right.
Beautiful. I guess with that, what is your process when creating a work tend to look like from start to finish?
So first I'll do some research. I read stories from my hapu, or I'll go through my family archives and look at names and try and decipher sort of what the time was like when they were named or things like that, and try and figure out what things mean or what they used to mean in te reo, not necessarily what they might translate to now. And then I'll go and harvest harikiki, which takes some time. And the prep work takes a lot of time, especially when I have to go to work and then come home and do it. It's all pretty time sensitive as well. Depending on the project, it might take me, and if I'm working on multiple pieces at a time, it'll take me maybe like 2-3 weeks to process the materials before I can even start dyeing anything. And then I will go plan out patterns that I'm going to weave and try and work the stories into the symbols and other motifs and stuff that I've researched throughout this making process that I've gotten really into.
Beautiful. And I guess that nicely leads on to my next question. Part of your practice is blending traditional fibres from harakeke with contemporary material glass beads. And you've said that the two kind of explore a potential future of traditional Māori methods of making. What interests you about putting a contemporary spin on traditional practice?
I think just being a little bit different always feels kind of nice. You know? And people going, oh, wow, I haven't seen that before, or I didn't realize I could do that, or it feels right. Like I think about how my ancestors weren't, or our ancestors weren't too fussed about putting down their stone tools and picking up what the settlers brought and things like that. Like nothing in the past has really said that using something new is wrong and using something new is bad or anything like that. And I take inspiration from the Mata Aho collective, who sort of do things the same way. Like they will use new contemporary materials to create something from an Indigenous traditional background. And it's really effective. And I think it's also just fun to play around with stuff.
Totally. And I wanted to talk about the poem that you've written alongside this exhibition, because it also really ties the ideas together, and I think it's such a beautiful touch. Can you speak to the inclusion of this?
So I'm not good at writing paragraphs or complete sentences. So, the poetry style of writing works really well for me, and I think it also, because my practice is such a physically involved one, it's sort of hard to explain everything or get the viewer to really experience the work properly without having the style of writing like evokes more, I guess, and sort of brings people into the work more.
And this exhibition is a part of the Matariki celebrations on Karangahape Road. What does Matariki mean for you?
Well, growing up, it wasn't really the same as it is now. Like, it was just a time of year when the stars looked, you could see different stars. I guess, like, my grandmother, who was born in the 30s, she was brought up by someone who was born in the time of the treaty signing, so they didn't really celebrate Matariki in the way that we do now. It wasn't a hugely important thing, but what I guess what's really cool is that people are recognizing that part of our culture here in Aotearoa and now getting more into it, so I guess it's really special.
That was artist Esther Stone speaking to me about Taonga Toku Iho, an exhibition of hers opening at Melanie Roger Gallery next week. The opening event is from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. next Wednesday 18th. If you wish to head along, all are welcome.
Furious artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
We'll be right back to give you your arts guide. This is Mazzy Star.
Just to solve all his problems as he's bringing me down.
It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists.
It's paintings and that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tāmaki Makaurau, as mentioned on the show, a century of modern art is on now at Auckland Art Gallery, Toyo Tāmaki.
Also as mentioned on the show, Heatwave by Raisa McLean is on now at Room until the 5th of July.
And Taonga Tuku Iho by Esther Stone is opening at Melanie Roger Gallery on Wednesday, 18th of June. The opening event is from 5:30 till 7:30 p.m.
Tonight, two new exhibitions are opening at Seasons Aotearoa, Inflation by Gerard Dombrowski and A Lag by Tarika Sabril. If you want to head along to the opening, that's from 6 to 8 p.m. tonight.
And then tomorrow, Concrete, an exhibition by Ruth Cleland, opens at Suma Gallery. And the opening event is from 4 till 6 p.m. if you want to head along to that one.
Also opening tomorrow is an exhibition by Welsh artist Zareth Wynne Evans at Michael Lett Gallery.
And otherwise, we've got Tala Ole Tō, an exhibition by Angela Tiatia and Yuki Kihara on at Gus Fisher Gallery.
Dance Dance, an exhibition by Kate Vanderdrift, is on at Sanderson Gallery until the 22nd of June.
Differences in Kind and Rhythm is an exhibition by Peter Robinson and Italian painter Giorgio Griffa on at Te Uru Waitakere Contemporary Gallery until the 24th of August.
Also on at Te Uru, Life in Forms is a survey exhibition by Pauline Kahuranga, Yeboah's work until the 27th of July.
And Spoil Objects, an exhibition by Angela Pan, is on at Grace until the 28th of June. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us on various artists today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us.
Dr. Sophie Matheson,
Raisa McLean,
and Esther Stone. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com.
Ka hoki mai mātou a tērā wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove with Nigel. My name is Sophia.
And I'm Maya.
And that was various artists.
Sweet, we won't catch you next week.
Because it's Matariki, but we'll catch you in 2 weeks. You're listening to 95bfm. Ka kite.
Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.